Welcome to Meet the Writers. Today, I'm talking to an extraordinary man. Between his first novel, A Guide for the Perplexed, published in 1992, and his most recent book, Septimania, he's written plays and opera libretti. His political and cultural journalism has been published all over the world. He's a founding editor of the literary magazine Granta, and he's artistic advisor to the Zauberzee Festival in Lausanne in Switzerland. He's also co-director of the Gabriel Garcia Marquez Fellowship in Cultural Journalism in Cartagena, Colombia. Jonathan Levi, welcome to Meet the Writers.
Thank you, Georgina.
I think that introduction didn't really do you justice because you've achieved so much. Arguably, I'd say that one of your biggest contributions is inspiring other people. And I think just right at the beginning of this interview, we ought to have full disclosure in that you've had a really, really positive influence on my work. But I wonder what it is that inspires you, because you're a brilliant violinist, and I wonder if music was actually at the heart of your early creativity.
You know, it's a fascinating question to ask. I don't know. You know, music is something that I've played with since I was about 5 years old, and I grew up in a household with another family living upstairs. There were about six of them, and they all played the piano. So music was there from the very beginning. So somehow, the feeling that sound is important, and not just the surface level of meaning, but that's something about sound, the magic within sound, was important, is something that I've thought of since I was very young. Mm. And whether that's inspired anybody else, I'm not sure, but it's certainly something that I've thought of as I've now spent a lot more time with words, and I've thought about sounds of words and the music of words as much as anything else.
Yeah, and all of that, of course, weaves into your latest book, Septimania, which we're going to talk about in some detail a little bit later on. But I want to talk now more about your formative years, because I know that you went to Cambridge. But before that, tell me about growing up.
My father was a professor of philosophy and my mother a social worker, but she had also done a master's degree in English literature. And we bopped back and forth between New York City and Cleveland, Ohio, as my father was chasing tenure, but also spent what for me was a very significant year here in England when I was 10 years old, living up in North London while my father was on sabbatical. I think a lot of that meant that I never really felt like I was from one place or another. As I mentioned, you know, those early years of listening to a family playing piano upstairs in Cleveland were formative. I don't feel like I'm a person from Cleveland, even though I have a soft spot for the Cleveland Indians, for the baseball team from there, which has never won much of anything, nor for New York, for that matter, even though I've spent a lot of time. I moved back to New York, really finally, when I was in my second year of high school at the age of 14, and have lived there off and on ever since, which means for the last, 40-odd years. But it means that I've developed sort of a perspective of being someone who's neither here nor there, sort of perpetually in exile. And I found that to be a wonderful and very comforting kind of feeling.
Well, when you were away from home as a young adult at Cambridge, that was a really inspirational time. You achieved a huge amount there. You went to a very meaningful dinner party, which we'll talk about again when we speak about your book. But I know that that was also the time when you met Bill Bruford and various others with whom you co-founded Granta.
Well, I mean, it was an extraordinary time, partially because of the many English people that I met during that time, partially because Cambridge is Wizard of Oz, you know, drop dead gorgeous, but also because a lot of the expats and mostly the Americans were also there, like I was, on fellowships that, you know, we had won for better or for worse because of things we had done over 4 years back at undergraduate universities, which meant these people were really quite extraordinary. I mean, Bill Bruford, for instance, who was one of the two students there with whom I founded the new Granta, had won a Marshall Fellowship, and he had just done an entire edition of Shakespeare's sonnets with his professor out at the University of California at Berkeley. This was what everybody did who was out there. They were fascinating people. Rick Burns, who is another friend of ours and also helped to paste up the first issue of Granta in a fish and chip shop and in various pubs, went on to have a tremendous career as a documentary filmmaker. Don Guttenplan, who's still here in England and is a very widely respected journalist over here, was also there. So these were extraordinary people. And, you know, when you're around extraordinary people, you know, especially late at night, great ideas pop up.
Well, and Granter, of course, a wonderful idea. And you took this magazine and really made it into something which is absolutely flourishing today.
Well, I mean, we were very lucky in many ways. I think that often things that flourish are because somehow your own point of view and your taste intersects with the zeitgeist, with what's going on at the time. And we were lucky because Pete DiBala, who was the third member of our triumvirate that started the new Granta, had been tasked with the idea of coming up with an American issue for Granta, which was the undergraduate magazine at the time. It was a 16-page mimeographed rag that had been around for about 100 years. And so he asked me and Bill to come up with an American issue. And we did what most Americans do, which is, as you've seen in the recent elections, is, you know, bend the truth somewhat. So we wrote letters to 25 extraordinary American writers who were not being published in England at that time. Susan Sontag, Donald Barthelme, Tilly Olson, Ronald Coover, all kinds of people who didn't have publishers in England. And we said, listen, we'll give you half of the issue and we'll get people to write essays about you and reviews if you give us a piece of unpublished writing. And out of those 25 people that we wrote to, we got 19 responses, which meant we couldn't do 16 pages anymore. We couldn't just fund it by going and getting ads from the local Chinese takeaway. We had to expand into the paperback size book that people know as Granta today. And it sort of took off from there.
So career-wise, what happened to you after that?
Well, I decided that that really wasn't what I wanted to do. What I wanted to do was to be a theater director. And in fact, I spent most of my waking hours at Cambridge directing theater. In fact, Bill was one of my lead actors. We did Little Murders together. We did Long Day's Journey Into Night. And in our sort of crowning valedictory performance, we performed Sexual Perversity in Chicago by David Mamet on the same week that the first issue of Granta came out. So I went back to the United States believing I had a job as a dramaturg for the Brooklyn Academy of Music and said goodbye to Bill. We had done our first issue of Granta and said, I'm going back over there. And as soon as I got back to the United States, I found out that someone else had been hired for that job. And I went, oh, well. But continued to do theater. And at the same time, Bill said, listen, I think we should do a second issue. We should do a third issue. And so I opened up the U.S. office out of my apartment for Granta and started looking for American writers for the magazine at the same time that I was directing off-Broadway. I was teaching violin where I could. For a time, I had a very nice little gig at a private school where my star pupil, not because she was very good, but just because she was so nice as a 10-year-old, was a young girl named Jennifer Aniston. And did sort of odd jobs like that. I played a lot of violin. I played, I probably made most of my living in those days as a jazz violinist with a trio called the Savannah Sheiks. And we had a regular gig down around Times Square where we would play in a bar that Frank Sinatra occasionally frequented and did sort of odd jobs while Granta slowly started to make a little bit of a noise until finally I was able to put everything else aside and devote myself full time to the magazine.
And of course, you were writing yourself, though, at this time, too. I mean, short stories, certainly. You wrote about violin. The Scrimshaw violin is one of your pieces.
Well, you know, yes and no. I mean, in those, the more that I was involved with Granta in those days and the more that you edit and the more that you're working with extraordinary writers. I mean, we had, you know, writers who we were buying pieces from, like Graham Greene and Gabriel Garcia Marquez, but also writers we were working with very closely as they wrote their pieces, like Richard Ford and James Fenton. When you're working with extraordinary people like that, you know, your own writing ambitions, you know, go a little bit quiet for a while. And in fact, it wasn't until after I left Granta at the end of 1987 that I really started thinking, okay, I've got a few stories. I've got, you know, maybe a novel in me, maybe a few short stories, maybe some theatrical work, and especially theatrical work, because that didn't really conflict with what we were doing at Granta. Granta was all prose in those days, not even poetry. So you say, well, okay, well, that part of my mind can perhaps work its way around words for a bit. Mm.
Dante's Inferno, I know that that was a performance that were very involved in.
Well, that was a Dante's Inferno I got involved with because a friend of mine was running the Poetry Center at the 92nd Street Y, which is the major arts presenter in New York City, and was the place where Dylan Thomas premiered Under Milkwood, and all kinds of great things happened. And they'd gotten some money to take a work of classical literature and turn it into something else, and then tour it around the country. And at that point, Robert Pinsky, who was the poet laureate, had just published a new translation of Dante's Inferno that, to my ears, sounded like blues songs from Robert Johnson. I mean, it started off, in the middle of the road of life, I found myself in a dark wood, the right road lost. And I thought, the right road lost, you know, that could have been something that that Robert Johnson sang when he met the devil at the crossroads. So I spoke to Pinsky and got the rights from Pinsky to hire a director. And we hired four actors, two of whom are actually making a lot of noise right now. Reggie Cathy, you may have seen in The Wire and in House of Cards. He plays the barbecue guy, Freddie, and through there. Bill Camp, another wonderful actor, played Dante. And the two of them were Dante and Virgil. And we then took that around the country. We took it to strange places for theater. We played down at Martin Luther King's Ebenezer Baptist Memorial Church down in Montgomery, Alabama. We played at the Getty Center. And it made a bit of a splash. And it was a lot of fun. It was about 10 years after I had left Granta. So by that point, you know, I was indulging my theater Jones as much as anything else.
And it got you noticed by the New York Educational Authority.
Well, yes. I mean, part of that is that I'm very lucky. As I said before, the extraordinary guys that I met, like Bill Buford, Rick Burns, Don Guttenplan at Cambridge. Also, you live long enough, you make a lot of interesting friends. And Harold Levy, who became the chancellor of the New York City Board of Education, was a good friend of mine. And when he was appointed the chancellor, he asked me to come along essentially as the guy who was going to tell him when he was, shall we say, messing up, because I really didn't care. I kept saying, no, I don't want to go. I don't want to put on a suit and a tie. I don't want to actually sign a tax form. It was the first time in my life I had to sign something that said I had a salary. I had never had salaries before. It was always sort of, you know, fees here and there. But in fact, it was one of the best jobs I've ever had, because Harold was a terrific guy, and he let me essentially act like a free agent while I was there, or a loose cannon, as some other people might have said. And I was able to take over the brief of arts and culture for the New York City school system, which has more than a million kids involved. You know, I forget how many thousands of how many teachers. We had 643 elementary schools alone. So I was able to work with people, and we started a program to renovate all of the libraries in the elementary schools. I got a master class with Isaac Stern, the violinist, for all of our superintendents who ran all of the schools. And the superintendents were so taken by it that within 3 weeks, 20,000 more students were having violin classes in New York as a result. I mean, the numbers that exist in New York, as they are here in London, are just extraordinary if you can inspire someone's imagination. But that was all because I had this crazy friend who thought that it might be fun for me to get on the subway with him every morning and go to work.
Now, what about your own writing during this time?
Well, when I left Granta in the late 80s, I had an idea for a novel that eventually became A Guide for the Perplexed. And that was spawned mostly because a lot of people were pestering me in the 80s about a subject that I thought was entirely irrelevant to me, and that was essentially, what did I think about Israel? Now, I'm the grandson of two rabbis, but my parents both decidedly left religion at an early age. And though I learned bits and pieces about Judaism during the time, I didn't really pay much attention, and I certainly didn't pay attention to Israel. I had traveled, I had relatives in Israel, but I'm not Israeli, I'm American. What did I care? But after the Lebanon war of the early 80s, I couldn't really be glib about it anymore. And I figured, okay, I've got to come up with some type of answer in terms of what it meant to me to be a Jew and how that was different from being Israeli and what independence meant and what being a national meant and nationalism and all of this. And the more that I started thinking about it, the more I looked into the story of the expulsion of the Jews from Spain in 1492, which just happened to be on the same day that Columbus set off from Spain and wound up founding the New World. And I thought, well, maybe, you know, what if this wasn't a coincidence? You know, what if this, in fact, were Columbus's desire to find a new homeland? And I had traveled to Spain. I had been there in the late 70s. I had been kicked out of an airport on New Year's Eve, 1978-79, because of a wildcat strike in Madrid. So there are all these things kind of bubbling around in your head, and you think, well, what if all of these things somehow could connect together? And stories that I had about friends of mine in England, friends of mine in Germany, let's piece them all together. And I suppose that's really what writing a novel is about. You pull those things together, and you have a lot of fun. And fortunately, I was able to get, you know, someone to publish it.
Well, A Guide for the Perplexed did fantastically well. I mean, it was wonderfully reviewed. And yet, that was in 92, and you haven't written another novel until now. And I'm looking forward to talking about Septimania, but I want in the interim to find out what you were doing in that time. Because you got very involved with festivals too, didn't you?
Well, you know, part of it is that when one thing isn't working, you know, you try it, and then when it stops working, you do something else. And in fact, I wrote two novels in quick succession after A Guide for the Perplexed, but they were both about South America. I had gone down to South America to research one of these novels. My brother-in-law was working down there and having all kinds of adventures that I wanted to write about in a novel. But it was only after my agent was trying to sell that second South American novel that he said to me, you know, John, nobody wants a South American novel from a guy named Levi. If your name was Garcia Levi or Vargas Levi, well, you know, okay, but, you know, it's just not working. And at that point, in fact, I had started what was sort of the Septimania. I had started this new novel. But it wasn't so much fun when you've just had two novels rejected. And that's when offers came along to do the Dante's Inferno. Other offers came along after that. I started visiting South America for a variety of other reasons, just as a matter of fact, when I was researching that next novel that was called The Political Sun. The next time I went down to Cartagena, Colombia, I was invited to be a judge in the Miss Colombia beauty pageant. And from that led to relationships that led to me, that as Cartagena started to develop, led to me being invited to be an advisor to the Cartagena Music Festival, and eventually to other music festivals as well.
Just on Cartagena for a moment, because I know that you were involved with the Gabriel Garcia Marquez Foundation. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, that was directly as a result. Again, you know, you talk to the right people. I was I decided for the music festival down there that I wanted to do a series of interviews, very much like what we're doing, for people to try and introduce them to classical music in ways that they would somehow get it. And I did one interview actually with a former Miss Colombia about music and beauty. I did one with an artist about music and art. And then I interviewed the Minister of Culture about music and politics. And afterwards, she said, that was a lot of fun. Could you put together a project for us to train cultural journalists down here in Colombia? And I said, well, okay, but I'm a gringo after all. You know, I should find some kind of ally down here. And the next afternoon, I met the Jaime Abello, who is the head of the president of the Gabriel Garcia Marquez Foundation for New Journalism, which Garcia Marquez had started with his Nobel Prize money in order to train new generations of journalists in South America, where unfortunately journalism was often checkbook journalism. You want your book well reviewed? Send an envelope of cash to, you know, Monocle Radio. And I said to Jaime, I said, look, the minister has invited me to do this. I feel a little bit uncomfortable being a gringo just doing this myself. What do you think? And over the course of a week, we came up with an idea of how we would go out and we would get 15 journalists from all over the world, five from Colombia, five from the rest of Latin America, and five from elsewhere, and bring them all together in Cartagena and use that as an opportunity to really have a meeting with these mid-career journalists, not just train them, not just teach them, but to bring them together in a way in which they would be in dialogue with us and with each other over issues of cultural journalism, which in my mind is sometimes the most interesting journalism that there is. That program started 5 years ago, and it's still going great guns.
Now, we've been flirting with this idea of Septimania right from the beginning. I mentioned a dinner party in Cambridge, which is where I think the whole idea possibly started. So take me back to what Septimania actually is?
Well, Septimania itself, really and truly, and cross my heart and hope to die, was a kingdom in the south of France. It was what we think of now as perhaps Western Languedoc, even though Languedoc is not necessarily exactly defined today. But they... But back in the 9th century, back in the 8th and the 9th century, it was a kingdom. And according to one historian, it was a kingdom that Charlemagne gave to the Jews of that region in thanks for delivering Narbonne from the Saracens, from the Moors, the Muslims, who had come up from Spain and were controlling that part of France. But he did it under one proviso. He said, I want you to send away to Baghdad, where the Jews were living in exile, and send me a prince of the Jews. Because I want this prince to come and to rule over Septimania. And I also want him to do another thing. I want him to marry my daughter. Because he knew that the prince of the Jews, the king of the Jews living in exile, was descended from King David. And King David was also the ancestor of a guy known as Jesus. And Charlemagne figured it out that somehow if he could marry his daughter to someone from the line of Jesus, that would cement his own position as a leader of the West. And sure enough, in the year 800, Charlemagne then walked into Rome and had himself crowned by Leo III, the Pope, as the Holy Roman Emperor. So that's what Septimania is historically.
And it's produced this book, which the Wall Street Journal asks, can wisdom alone or science overcome evil? People have said it adds new dimensions to the idea of a novel. The Kirkus Review said, a thoroughly intellectual postmodern fable, wise yet melancholy, meant to be read slowly and savoured. Now, I have seen and read so many different reviews of this book, ranging from it should never have been published, written in a really angry way. Somebody clearly very affected by the book and just cross that it was out there in the first place, to beautiful, beautiful reviews saying that this is the most extraordinary book. And I think for me, there's a little page on, I think it's page 170, which kind of sums up, and I don't think it's a spoiler to say this, but in this country of Septimania, you believe that if you find the answer to Newton, if you bring all of the world's religions under your belt, then you will also buy peace in our time and find your girl, the one girl. It's about numbers, it's about the one girl, and of course, crucially, it's about Isaac Newton.
Well, yes. I mean, in a way, it's one big theme of it. I mean, the title is Septimania, which sounds like seven mania. And Septimania, the kingdom, may have been named after seven churches, but there's something
or
about
the Roman, the Roman legion of the seventh Roman legion.
Yeah, it's possible. I mean, what do we know? I mean, the history of Charlemagne was written by two guys. One was a contemporary named Einhard, who was a Saxon monk, and the other was a guy named Nutker the Stammerer. So, you know, I feel that as a fiction maker, I can sort of do it as I want. But the idea of seven is certainly within the title. But the idea of monomania, the way in which so much of our lives is centered around believing that there's like a single origin. We're looking for the Big Bang. You know, we're looking for the one reason of life, the meaning of life. So many monotheistic religions have sprung up. You know, what's all of this about one? Why is one so important? You know, with apologies to my wife, you know, why just one woman? You know, it's where do we get this idea of one from? And much of the tension of the book is between my hero Mallory, who is convinced that there is one woman. He meets this one woman, he falls in love with her, and then she disappears, and he spends most of the book looking for her. And another character, Tibor, who in fact suffers from Septimania, from a belief that somehow maybe there's more than one reason for the world to exist. Maybe there's more than one goal. Certainly there's more than one woman that's out there. And in that war, you know, one is going to be right and one is going to be wrong, and it can have consequences.
It's a fantastic tale. I mean, it ranges from the Arabian Nights all the way through to 9/11. It encompasses a huge piece of history. But I'm interested in that you're talking about only one, because what you do also in the writing is you flip between the third and the first person, and sometimes it's not even the same first person.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's a trick that's not without difficulties. As I say, there are consequences that as you bring a reader into a book, You want to bring the reader into a sympathy with a main character. That's the easy way that people like to read books. They want to identify. And what happens if you change that first person from one person to another? What you're asking them to do is to split their affinities, to split their sympathies. And that often is tough. And I've got to say that in the writing and the rewriting, because I'm no different from any other novelist, rewriting is the part of the iceberg that's below the surface that's just enormous. You play around with it until you feel that you somehow get a balance that works for you. It maybe doesn't work for all of those readers out there, but what you're trying to say is, look, you know, maybe your sympathy for this one character puts you too much as a monotheist. Maybe you should think that there are a couple of characters here that may have the answer.
Now, we started off talking about music, and music, again, is really big in this book. He's an organ scholar, the main protagonist, and the whole rhythm of the book feels very musical, and the whole theme of music weaves in and out. And I know that actually that there's an imaginary band, or perhaps not imaginary, that there's a band that exists in on various different levels, if you like. And that's actually a song that you recorded.
Yes. Well, I invented a band called the Unimaginables, which I imagined as a girl band, a little bit like the Runaways, if you remember Joan Jett and the song Cherry Bomb from back, I don't know, the 70s, the 80s, back from my time. And I decided, I was told by my publisher, because I had been away from publishing for a long time, that there were these things called book trailers that we, you know, little movies that you would make and put on YouTube to go out and advertise your book. And I looked at a bunch of these, and they all seemed kind of smarmy and, you know, self-involved and really not much to do with the book. And I said, well, let me do something with music, because I think music is something I know. Let's make a music video. So I imagined what this band, the Unimaginables, would sound like. I got an old music friend of mine from Cambridge, a guy named Andy Metcalf, who had gone on and performed with Squeeze and Robin Hitchcock and the Egyptians and all kinds of great bands. And he helped me produce this. And I wrote this song called Unimaginable that comes straight out of the book, in which this group, the Unimaginables, sing it. And I brought it to life, and it was a great deal of fun doing that.
One, let me divide, one over zero.
It's an extraordinary book, as it's been described, a masterpiece, a rule-bending, category-smashing, delightful work of brilliance. Jonathan, we had to leave it there, but if you were to categorise it, if you were to put it on a library shelf, where would it go?
Ooh, I don't know. It's a book. It's there's a great line from Cervantes, from Don Quixote, that talks about history, the mother of truth. And I once asked a friend of mine, a Mexican novelist, I said, if history is the mother of truth, who's the father? And he said, well, fiction, of course. And so it's a fiction, but it might be the father of truth or the mother.
Septimania is published by Duckworth. It's out now, Jonathan Levi. It has been, as ever, a pleasure.
Thank you, Georgina.
You've been listening to Meet the Writers with me, Georgina Godwin. Thanks very much to Kieran Banerjee, our sound engineer, researcher at Barclay Brown. And you can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, MixCloud, or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.